From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. A brief programming note, we were planning to begin today's show with the conversation on Jelani Day, the ISU grad student who went missing 4 years ago this weekend. Our guest for that part of the show is running a little late, so we're postponing that to the second half of the program. Instead, we begin with Lindsay Addario. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist whose striking images from nearly every theater of war in the 21st century tell the story of the people living in these conflict zones, including the women of Afghanistan under the Taliban. Her photojournalism has appeared frequently in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. She's also the author of the best-selling memoir It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She joined the 21st Show back in November of 2021 to talk about what life was like in Afghanistan, especially for women during the Taliban's rule, how life changed for women in the 20 years she's been covering the country, and more. Since we're revisiting this conversation, we will not be taking calls live, but we still want to hear your thoughts. Talk@21stshow.org is our email address. Talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now my conversation with Lindsay Addario. Lindsay, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you grew up in Connecticut. You got your first camera, a Nikon FG, when you were about 13. But you say even when you went to college in Wisconsin, you thought photographers were trust fund dilettantes. Can you talk about when things clicked for you that this was a career you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, I never actually took photography seriously when I was in high school and growing up. And maybe that's because I was raised by artists. I was raised by two hairdressers in a very sort of open, eccentric household. And everyone around us in my childhood was some sort of artist. And so I guess for me, I kind of shied away from that. And so I was determined to sort of work at the UN or do something international, go overseas, but I never connected the dots that photography, photojournalism could be something like the marriage of international relations, of politics, and travel.
Yeah, and in fact, you're in Argentina, I think, when things start to begin to come together, you write in your memoir. And, you know, there's an experience involving Madonna. I don't know if you want to tell that story and sort of like the technology of cameras. Go ahead. We'll start with that.
Well, let's see. I kept going into the Buenos Aires Herald, which was the English newspaper based in Buenos Aires. And I kept going in there and asking for a job. And there were two men who were running the photo department. And they sort of looked at me and they were like, you have no photo experience. Sort of go away and come back when you learn Spanish. So I learned Spanish very quickly because I already spoke Italian. And I kept going in and saying, you know, give me an assignment. And they got so annoyed with me that finally, sort of a month later, they said, look, Madonna is filming Evita at the Casa Rosada. And if you can sneak on set and get a picture of Madonna, we'll give you a job. And I was like, okay, I can do this, you know? And so I went onto the set. And of course, there was a very tight perimeter. And most of the security, they were like New Yorkers or Americans. And so I went up and I said to the guy, you know, hey, let me explain something. My entire career rests in your hands. And if you let me in and if you let me onto the press riser, I'm going to become a really famous photographer one day. The guy, I must have sounded so pathetic because he let me on. And I remember all I had was this little tiny camera with a 50mm lens. And I got onto the press riser. And of course, all the people around me had these like Hubble telescopes of lenses, and giant lenses. And Madonna, where she was going to appear on the balcony, was like, I don't know, 500 feet away. She was miles away. So I raised my camera to my eyes, sort of very triumphant that I had gotten that far, and realized I couldn't see a thing. And so I just sort of stood there. And one of the photographers took pity on me and basically tapped me on the shoulder and said, look, just take the lens off your camera and put your camera back on my lens. And I was so green. I had no experience that I didn't even realize my Nikon camera could fit on the back of his giant lens. And so he basically helped me. And I put my eye to the frame and I couldn't believe she was right there, you know, or at least the balcony was right there. And so I took a picture and I went back and I got a job.
That's great. I love that story. And I had a similar experience. I mean, as a radio guy, I would occasionally bring my little SLR camera with its 50 millimeter or so zoom lens. And I did have a friend from a paper who said, here, try this. It was really eye opening. But it was in Argentina. You also say you saw an exhibit of a photographer, Salgado, who had, you write that he captured his subject's dignity. Can you talk about what you've learned about capturing the dignity of your subjects in your photographs?
Yeah, I mean, I remember walking into that exhibit, and it was his worker series, and the prints were sort of wall-sized, and the expressions on people's faces were a combination of sort of incredibly proud, but also the hardship they had been through. And so I was so overwhelmed because I didn't realize that still photographs could actually have such a great impression. And so for me, you know, I could only ever aspire to be half the photographer Sebastian Salgado is, but I know that for me, I always, wherever I am and whatever I'm photographing, whatever subject and whoever I'm photographing, I'm always looking to make sure that I treat people with respect and that their dignity comes across in the photos. And I think, you know, the subjects I cover are incredibly tough. They're tough subjects. And so that's not always easy, but it's really important for me to A, make sure people, you know, understand where the images will appear and how they'll appear and do they want to be a part of that? And to make sure I capture their, you know, how they're feeling in that moment.
When you're in really remote places, what sort of understanding do they have, right? I mean, especially in the late 90s under the Taliban in Afghanistan, I'm imagining, do they have a sense of what it means to be in, you know, a major Western newspaper?
Of course. I think, you know, every place is different. And I always travel with a translator, someone who is from that area or someone who can explain in detail, because some people are illiterate, obviously, and they don't understand sort of the breadth with which a photograph can make its way kind of around the world, especially now with social media. So if you look at the images I took in Afghanistan in 2000, before 9/11, people were quite aware because Afghanistan wasn't always under the Taliban. Of course, it was in the 60s and 70s, it was quite open. And so people understood what journalism was. They understood where those images would appear, that they would go internationally. But ironically, because all sort of media was banned, television was banned under the Taliban, there were no newspapers, magazines, people weren't so nervous about having their photographs taken because the chances of those images making their way back into Afghanistan at that time were next to impossible. So people were quite excited about sharing what they were going through, the fact that, you know, girls couldn't go to school or the hospitals had no medicine and all of the things that were happening under the Taliban. People were happy to sort of allow me to take their photo and tell the world how difficult it was because they weren't worried about those images really coming back.
How did you manage to take, especially before 9/11, how did you manage to take those photos? Because as I understand it, the Taliban did not allow photographs of people. and certainly as a woman, you would have been under tremendous restrictions, but I guess it was also an advantage in some ways, right? In terms of access.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the fact that I was a woman is sort of the sole reason that I was able to get the access, because when I first arrived in the country, I had a visa from the Taliban. So they knew I was there. They knew I was a photographer. I said I was photographing the destruction from war, so buildings, essentially. And yes, photography of any living thing at the time was illegal, was banned. And so as a woman, though, I was able to enter into people's private homes, and I was able to take pictures of people inside the women's hospital, in secret girls' schools. I went to a secret wedding on the streets. It was very stressful and very difficult to photograph because I had to sort of pull my camera out very quickly, take a picture and hide it again in my bag and hope I didn't get caught. So photographing on the street was much more difficult than actually being inside with other people in their private homes.
How did 9/11 change the focus of your work, I guess? Because we've just been saying, you were in Afghanistan before, you spent a lot of time there since, but what change did that make for you?
I mean, it was sort of, it changed everything for me, really. I mean, when I really started taking photography seriously and realized in Argentina that I actually wanted to be a photojournalist and that this was a profession that I actually had been unaware of previously, and that it was something I wanted to do. I went to Afghanistan initially because I was curious about the situation for women living under the Taliban. I had been reading articles in the New York Times about, you know, life under the Taliban, and I wanted to go. And I was genuinely, you know, I went and photographed. But after 9/11, you know, suddenly it became a top story. And by the way, when I was there under the Taliban, I couldn't give those pictures away. I think it was like no one cared about pictures of Afghanistan before 9/11. And so, you know, I think the LA Times published a few, but really no one was interested in those photos. And it wasn't until after 9/11, of course, that the fact that I had been there three times under the Taliban, I was quite familiar with how life was there. I suddenly realized, okay, I want to cover the war that's about to happen. And I had an asset because I was familiar with the area and had a photograph there. And so I started covering I flew right to Pakistan. I covered sort of the lead up to the fall of the Taliban and then covered the fall of the Taliban in Kandahar.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Lindsay Addario, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who's documented life in Afghanistan under the Taliban for nearly two decades, as we've been talking about, as well as in many, many other conflict zones in the past few decades. So I've read that you speak at length with the subjects you photograph, and you talked about making sure they understand, you know, where the work is going to go. But is that universal among photographers in your experience? Do they all have these sort of extended conversations, build relationships with their subjects?
I don't know. It's hard for me to say how other photographers work, of course, because, you know, in the last sort of 10 years, increasingly, I'm working on feature stories, often pegged to a news event, but I'm on my own. I'm with me, a driver, and a translator. And so it's hard for me to know how other photographers work. Sure. I think for me, I like doing comprehensive reporting. It's very important for me to understand someone's story in order to be able to photograph them accurately. Sometimes I get ideas for how to photograph them only through the interview. I'm also increasingly asked to write articles alongside the photos I take. And so, you know, for me, it's really important to understand the person I'm photographing and to also be able to, you know, not only send a photograph of them to the world, but send the message that they are trying to convey. You know, why are they letting me into their life? It's really important because I often meet people at their most vulnerable moments.
So we need to take a break in about 3 minutes. So I want to ask you about Afghanistan before 9/11, after 9/11, and then today, where things are going with the U.S. withdrawal. But can you talk about the progress that women in Afghanistan, you know, were allowed or made for themselves, I guess I should say, right? Joining parliament. It was so limited. I think I read that only women, a very select few women doctors were allowed to sort of like have actual jobs under the Taliban. Can you talk about after 9/11, how that changed?
Yeah, I mean, in order to talk about after, I probably should just preface it for what it was like before. I mean, the first three times I went, the only women that I saw on the streets were widows, people who were begging because they had no man in their family to provide for them. So, you know, it was a pretty desperate scene of seeing people, you know, the only women outside were begging. And then school education for girls was illegal. And so that was also, you know, the only girls who were in school were in secret girls' schools in sort of basements of houses or in courtyards, places where the Taliban wouldn't find out. Women who were able to work were sort of handpicked. The Taliban allowed certain women to work as doctors or nurses in hospitals. Very few other people. There certainly were no women police. So it was definitely women's lives were relegated to the home, really.
And then after 9/11, that really begins to open up, right, with schools and education and serving in government. And even you have photos of women training as police, which I don't know that even I had seen that previously, frankly, until I started looking through your work.
Yeah, I mean the sort of advances and the how women's lives changed from before 9/11 to after was extraordinary. I mean, women were educated, you know, to go to a graduation of women graduating from the University of Kabul in literature, to see women voting in elections, to see women running for parliament, to see women really out in the public sphere. Yes, it boxing, you know, training for sports, to be jogging in the stadium where there had been public executions under the Taliban. All of those things were extraordinary because they were so absolutely different from how life was under the Taliban.
All right. We're speaking with Lindsay Addario. She is a photojournalist, Pulitzer Prize winning photojournalist, and the author of the memoir, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Also a collection of photographs called Of Love and War. We're going to continue this conversation. We do need to take a break, though. We're going to talk about what's been happening in Afghanistan lately with the U.S. withdrawal and more with Lindsay Addario. After a short break, you're listening to the 21st. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're revisiting my conversation from November 2021 with Lindsay Addario. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who's documented life in Afghanistan under the Taliban for two decades. As we continue, you'll hear some discussion of the war in Afghanistan that had just recently ended when we first broadcast this conversation. Let's jump in where we left off. So you have written recently in The Atlantic about as the U.S. occupation was ending, I wonder what has been going through your mind. You've written that you're getting messages from people there asking for help, you know, translators, other people you've, subjects of yours from over the years. How are you processing what happened in Afghanistan in the last few months?
Well, I think the hardest time definitely was in August when it all started going down, August and September. I think, you know, no one expected, obviously, the Taliban to take over so quickly. It was incredibly heartbreaking to see, you know, the scenes of Afghans falling from military aircraft, just desperate to try to get out. I think there were so many people that we made promises to that we would help get them out or get them visas in a sort of dignified way. People who risked their lives, either working for the military or working for various organizations, including foreign journalists. And all of those people were at risk. And I think, you know, a lot of the people that I was hearing from, you know, initially when the Taliban took over, my phone was blowing up like anyone else who's worked in Afghanistan extensively. I had translators, I had, you know, colleagues, other journalists, people just saying, I have to get out. I'm terrified. The Taliban's, you know, outside my window. They're going house to house asking who's worked with foreigners. No one really knew, you know, and these are people that the U.S. government, that we as journalists, we sort of said, you know, you're free now. The Taliban's gone. You know, exercise your freedoms, get educated, work as, you know, in whatever your dreams are, go for it now. And then suddenly overnight, that all was taken away. And so it was incredibly heartbreaking. It was humiliating to think of all the soldiers who lost their lives. You know, it was on so many levels. It was just so devastating.
George Packer also wrote in The Atlantic, I think a day before your piece came out, who said Biden's betrayal of Afghans will live in infamy was the headline. I wonder, do you feel like there was a betrayal there? Or, I mean, I know you're a journalist. Maybe you don't want to go into that, but I wonder if you have a perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, I am a journalist, but I'm also a human being. You know, I have worked in Afghanistan for 20 straight years. And I think Of course there's a betrayal. You know, I think that people really counted, Afghans really counted on Americans. You know, no Afghan expected us to stay there forever. Of course they knew we would leave, but do it in a dignified way. Do it in a way where the people who worked for the American government, who worked for the troops, who worked with journalists, you know, give them time to get visas. You know, don't close the embassy before the security, or don't pull the security before everyone has their visas, you know? So I think it was a betrayal. And I think for any journalist like myself who covered Iraq and then covered this, you know, it's pretty hard. What do you say to people you've worked alongside for years? You know, how do you justify this? You know, what do you say to them? It's very difficult to come up with a response.
I want to take a step back and look sort of at the arc of your work. I love the title of your memoir. It's What I Do, right? Because you can read it as a sort of a defiant note. You can read it maybe with a little resignation. And you have a line in there that stuck with me. It says, "The sadness and injustice I encountered as a journalist could either sink me into a depression or open the door to a new vision of my own life." And you say you chose the new vision. How did you come to that decision? How do you avoid sinking into depression, given some of the very difficult subjects you've covered?
Yeah, I mean, it's a question I get asked a lot. You know, doesn't this job make me depressed? You know, all the stories of hardship and war that I've seen year after year. And actually, the answer is no, because the people I cover are so unbelievably resilient. They keep their head up. They try to move forward. I've seen people in the most desperate situations still show incredible generosity and strength. And you know, for me, I'm always trying to learn from the people around me. I'm trying to sort of see the best in what I'm seeing. And sometimes that's impossible because situations are pretty miserable and pretty grave. But I also think, you know, first of all, I come from an incredible place of privilege. You know, I'm the one who chooses to go to these places and I can leave. Most people live in these existences forever and they can't get out. And so I think it's important to recognize all of these things and to not sort of take pity on myself. You know, how dare I become depressed? You know, my role is to sort of bring their messages out to the public so there can be change.
I understand your memoir this was news years ago, but it was optioned for a film with Steven Spielberg attached and Jennifer Lawrence set to play you. I wonder if you know anything about, are you involved with that? And how do you feel about, you know, potentially seeing that come to life someday?
I'm pretty involved in it. It's no longer Steven Spielberg and Jennifer Lawrence. The sort of team has evolved over the years. Anyone who knows Hollywood knows how these things go. They often take years to come together. We are looking now at a series, actually, a limited series. And so that's really exciting to me because I think our world has really changed. You know, I think it's really exciting, the idea of doing the story in sort of chapters, you know, television or series, because it's also what more people watch, I think, right now. And so that's kind of in the works. And how does it feel? It feels really strange. I mean, I never, you know, of course, I don't feel like I'm that important, that my life merits a series, but hopefully it will bring attention to the stories I cover and the people I cover. And also for young women out there, you know, to see a woman like myself in a profession that's usually populated by men, that's exciting to be able to be that sort of role model to women.
Lindsay Addario is the author of the book It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She also has a sort of coffee table sized book of photographs called Of Love and War. Lindsay, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.